Sangye chu tong so ki na na chang chu ba lu da ni kya su chi da li jin so gi pi so nam gi dro la pen chu sangye chu par shu. Go for refuge until I am enlightened. To the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the assembly of saints, for the virtuous merits that I collect by the practice of giving and the other perfections, may I attain the state of a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened. To the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the assembly of saints, for the virtuous merits that I collect by the practice of giving and the other perfections, may I attain the state of a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May all beings have happiness in the causes of happiness. May all beings be free from suffering in the causes of suffering. May all beings never be separated from bliss, which is sorrowless. May all dwell in equanimity, free from aversion and clinging. The ground is covered with flowers, sprinkled with scented water. In the middle is Mount Meru, surrounded by the four continents and ornamented by the sun and the moon. By visualizing all this and offering it as a Buddha robe, may all sentient beings partake of the Buddha's pure lands. Om Guru Buddha Bodhisattva Saparivara Ratnamandala Buddha Mega Samudra Saparana Samaya. Okay, we welcome Clarifying the Sage's Intent. This text is a text by Sakya Pandita, who was surely one of the great minds of all time. He's also a historical figure. He did a lot of historical things, going to various countries and spreading Dharma and teaching and so on. So I thought it might be interesting to just hear a little bit of his biography tonight. And there's a new translation of the Sakya history by Chogi Trichin Rinpoche that just came out, that I just got. And we have an excellent reader tonight that's going to read this story for us before we start the actual text. Good. This is a piece of the story, okay. Part of it.
Drakpa Gyaltshen, nephew and son of his brother, Polchen Obo, was the great Manjushri emanation Sakya Pandita. Like the Buddha, he made five choices about his future birth from incarnating. He entered his mother's womb in the form of a Naga king wearing a jewel ornament. His mother then experienced a meditative absorption unlike anything she had experienced before. When he was born, everywhere was filled with light. He uttered many Sanskrit words. On his bodily form, one could see physical auspicious marks that adorned it as a result of his having previously accumulated an inestimable amount of merit, a yunisa on the crest of his head and a tuft of hair, white as a conch, as a whorl in the center of his forehead, with such an appearance that those beholding him could hardly tear their gaze away. He was born in the water tiger of the third cycle, 1182. He was widely reputed that Manjushri had blessed Sakya Pandita continuously for 25 prior rebirths as a human and a religious scholar. On the level of the definitive meaning, his biography mentions many reasons proving his being an incarnation of Manjushri, such as his being prophesied by Tara to Kanche Panchen, and what the great scholar Tsongtapka and Lajje Bigi witnessed in their visions. On the level of the interpretable meaning, in this life he attained fearless confidence in all fields of learning, having mastered them by just leaping through the text or after just quick and superficial study. Viewing his main guru, Drakpa Gyaltshen, as being none other than Manjushri, he gained mastery over all eternal and external signs and interdependent relations. Moreover, he studied under countless Indian, Nepalese, Kashmiri, and Tibetan spiritual teachers, becoming a vast reservoir of perfectly replete wisdom that he achieved through study, reflection, and meditation, and thus he became lord of the entire Buddhist teaching. Since the time he took vows of four ordination from the very strict Vijnana adherent Sakya Sri Bhadra of Kashmir until the end of his life, he did not commit even the slightest infraction like the Arhat Arya Upali. And since his discipline was so superior in a way pleasing the Buddhas, he was praised by everyone in both worldly and transcendental spheres, and becoming supremely worthy of worship. Possessing virtues of learning, saintliness, and kindness, with the blazing of his great bodhicitta and qualities of realization, Sakyapandita began to act for the benefit of many living beings, and hence his fame spread far and wide. By thoroughly mastering both inner and outer fields of knowledge, he perfected them, and thanks to his working for the Dharma through teaching, debate, and composition, his fame reached India. And as a result, six non-Buddhist Indian scholars, led by Haryananda, came to confront him in the border town of Kirang. Sakyapandita refuted each of them in turn through his reasoning based by the three means of knowledge, Pramana. Silencing their objections after his defeat, Haryananda cut his hair as a sign of submission and promised to follow the Buddhist path. And the report spread widely and rapidly like the wind through India of the first Tibetan to ever defeat an Indian scholar in debate, calling him Lord of Teachers, Tibetan Pandita. That title Pandita spread for the first time in Tibet.
Yeah, thank you. So that's just one of many stories about Sakyapandita and what a great, not only scholar, but teacher, practitioner, politician, even. The statue that we have here, the size of it indicates the importance that he has in the Sakya school. And you can see in the statue his Ushnishna on his head. And they didn't put a circle of hair on his forehead, they put a diamond, but that indicates another of the signs of Buddhas, where they can emanate lights, and the lights have capacities and powers that go out and do things. He had all of those signs as a living person. Maybe as we go, we'll hear some more of pieces of his biography. But it's good to know who these people are and where these texts are coming from. We've been talking about the perfection, specifically the perfection of generosity, what the definition is, what the nature of it is, how to practice it, and so on. And also, what distinguishes generosity from the perfection of generosity. One of the requirements is that the generosity be sealed with emptiness. We talked a little bit about that. Now, there is a mantra, Om Ye Dharma He Tu Prabhava He Tun Tagan Tathagata Hayo E Tetikan Saya Naroda Ewam Wadi Mahashramana Ye Soha, which is the dependent origination mantra, which is a sealing mantra. That if you say that mantra at the end of your practice, you sealed it with emptiness. In fact, here at the center, generally in the pujas, we say that mantra at the end. And so that's another way you can seal your practice with emptiness, is by reciting that mantra. It might sound long if that's the first time you've heard it, but it's like anything, if you just repeat it enough. If I can do it, you can do it. We're going to continue with generosity tonight, because it's a big topic and we haven't finished it. So tonight we're going to start with, what are the obstructions to the perfection of generosity? Sakyapandita lists three obstructions: miserliness, or stinginess if you prefer, impure generosity, and the lack of an enlightenment thought. any or all of those can be obstructions to the perfection of generosity. Remember, generosity and the perfection of generosity are not necessarily the same. So, His Holiness the 42nd Sakyatrizin starts out the discussion by saying that we need to understand before we get into this that there are there's impure and pure generosity. So what he says is, generosity itself is of two kinds, pure and impure. Pure generosity also has three kinds, just like there are three kinds of refuge. Practicing pure generosity to protect yourself from fear, practicing pure generosity to attain good mundane results, and practicing pure generosity based on the wish to gain liberation from the whole of samsara. But the first two kinds of generosity are not the real perfection of generosity because of their inferior intention. The perfection of generosity must be based on the wish to gain liberation from the whole of samsara as our motivation. To practice generosity based on this intention is the cause of gaining liberation and eventually Buddhahood. His Holiness goes on to say that, going back to stinginess, there's two types, or two faults of stinginess. One is the negative results that come to you in this life, and the negative results that you experience in future lives. So we're talking about miserliness here. And he says, there are two types of faults. The negative results we experience in this life and those we experience in future lives. First, if we have the wealth, power, or other means, but we fail to practice generosity out of a disregard for others' well-being, we'll not be respected by others, and we may even be despised. We should therefore use our resources in a proper way. Regardless of how much wealth we may acquire, we can't take anything with us in our next life anyway. And not only must we leave all of our wealth and property behind, but we must also discard our own body and go to an unknown destination. So there really is no benefit in being stingy. The second negative outcome of stinginess is that we will also destroy the happiness that we might have otherwise had in our future lives. Stinginess is the opposite of generosity, and it's the cause of being born in the hungry ghost realm. And even if we could be free of the suffering of that miserable existence, and we could be born in a human realm, we will be born into poor conditions as a result of our stinginess. We should therefore free ourselves of stinginess and practice generosity as much as possible. However, if our practice of generosity is impure, it's like planting seeds in a salty field. It will not yield good results. Talking about the antidotes to miserliness, impure generosity, and lack of enlightenment thought, Aparipshe says, regarding miserliness, with regard to the fault of miserliness, we should be aware that although using our possessions may bring us some happiness during this lifetime, giving our things away to others will be a source of happiness to others in this life and to ourselves in future lives. However, if instead of using our possessions for our own benefit or for giving them away to others, we just hold on to them through miserliness, this will produce nothing but suffering, both in this life and in the next life. Miserliness leads only to suffering. There is absolutely no benefit in it. Sakyapandita explains that if we give away our property in this life, it's just like putting it into a secure bank. We will be provided with whatever we need in our future lives. In other words, there's great benefit in being generous because the results will be available to be used at some time in the future. On the other hand, if we are miserly, we will never be able to use our things, and somebody else will eventually take them and make use of them. We will be just like bees which work so hard to gather honey only to have it removed by someone else. If we are miserly in this life, the result will be rebirth in the realm of the hungry ghosts. And then, even if we do gain a human rebirth after coming out of the hungry ghost realm, we will experience dire poverty. The Clarifying Sage's intent was the textbook for the first year of the Complete Path course. And in that course, Kempo Jampa said that this last expression of dire poverty means we will have a lack of insight and we will not have success in daily life. That's what dire poverty means here. Now, in regard to the obstacle of impure generosity, Ape Rinpoche continues on saying, if we give impurely, there will be no benefit either in this lifetime or in the future, only suffering. For example, if we plant a seed in salty earth, it will be impossible for the seed to ripen and for the plant to grow and bear fruit. It's akin to giving a dead fish to a bird which is only able to consume live fish. Instead of helping, we harm the bird. To give some examples of what impure generosity might look like, there's lots of examples. There could be an impure receiver. The example that's listed in the text is to give to a king. Now, you have to remember these texts were written centuries and centuries ago. So I think today it might be to give to a multi-billionaire. In other words, they don't need it. That's not where the resources need to go. Or the object itself could be impure. For example, you don't give a weapon or poison as a gift. That's not the perfection of generosity. Or you might have an impure motivation. For example, you might expect something in return. Oh, if I give somebody this, they'll give me something back. Or even, they gave me something, so I feel like I got to give them something. That it's just another version of that. That's not really the perfection of generosity. That's what they call impure generosity. Also, just giving surplus, because you need room in your drawers or something. That's not what we're talking about, perfection. As far as the third one, the lack of enlightenment thought, even if we engage in giving pure gifts, our giving will not be a cause for gaining Buddhahood unless we produce the enlightenment thought. Although we may gain certain benefits through giving, even if we do not produce the enlightenment thought, the result will be experienced only once, and then it will be exhausted, never to increase. One may gain wealth in a future rebirth, for instance, but this benefit will only be for a short duration, as long as we aim for our own personal liberation. Even if we dedicate the merit will soon be exhausted and will not increase. So that's miserliness, impure generosity, and lack of enlightenment thought. And now we go to the topic in the text of how to overcome unfavorable conditions. Ape Rinpoche says, next we will examine the remedy for overcoming unfavorable conditions to practicing the perfection of generosity. When we look at the antidote for miserliness, we should realize that miserliness is just a product of our desirous attachment. That being the case, desirous attachment must be overcome. To do so, we should first come to an understanding of its disadvantages and how it causes us to suffer. First, we suffer through struggling to collect the things we want. And once we obtain them, we worry about protecting them from theft or destruction by others. And when they are finally destroyed or stolen, we experience the suffering of their loss. So, desirous attachment causes suffering at every stage of our involvement with possessions, from the time of trying to acquire them to the time of trying to keep them, right up to the time of losing them. There is therefore absolutely no point in being attached to possessions. And then there's a discussion about contentment. Geshe Tashi Namgo used to say, be content with what you have. It's a good means to have happiness, but don't be content with how much practice you're doing. Apa Rinpoche and his discussion about this has a story. There is a story to illustrate the unfavorable consequences of not being satisfied with our possessions. There once was a king who became extremely powerful after inheriting his father's kingdom. He was known as a universal emperor because he had acquired all of the signs, such as 1,000 children, 1,000 wheels, and 1,000 elephants. And he had vast power over many men. In his kingdom, there were 500 meditators belonging to a heretical sect. One day, while meditating, they were disturbed by the noise of birds flying overhead. Thereupon, they made a wish that the wings of the birds would become diseased and they would lose their ability to fly. As a consequence of that wish, all of those birds lost the power of flight and had to walk on the ground from then on. Well, when the king saw this, he inquired how this had happened. He was told that this was the work of the meditators. The king decided he would not allow people with such evil thoughts to stay within the bounds of his kingdom, and accordingly he issued a proclamation banishing all 500 meditators. And since the king was so powerful and his kingdom was so vast, the fact that it spanned 4 continents, the meditators had nowhere to go except to the slopes of Mount Sumeru. Now this king possessed such merit that whatever he wished for would materialize. At one time, seeing that there would be great prosperity in the land if everyone had plenty of grain to eat, the king prayed, "May grain fall from the sky." Thereupon, a great rain of grain of all kinds fell from the sky. Well, naturally, the people became curious to know whose merit caused this. They wondered whether it had happened due to their own merit or to that of the king. So they asked the king on several occasions. Finally, the king made the wish, "May a great rain of jewels fall onto the grounds of the palace, and may only coins fall outside of it." The king told the people that it had been a great mistake on their part to think that the rain of grain resulted from their merit. It was because of their improper thinking that the jewels had fallen only onto the palace. Otherwise, the jewels would have fallen throughout the kingdom. In any case, he gave the jewels away. From time to time, this king would ask his subjects whether there were any parts of the world not under his control, and whenever they told him about such places, he went out and conquered them. He also went to the ocean, where there were great kingdoms of Naga spirits, and he conquered them too. He ventured as far as Mount Sumeru, where the Naga spirits were living along with various lower heavenly deities. Because they put up such strong resistance, the king made a wish that whoever fought him would have to run away. So vast was his merit that everyone who fought against him did indeed run away. Thus he was able to conquer all the lower parts of Mount Sumeru as far as the lower heavens. And finally he arrived at the heaven of the 33, the abode of the great heavenly king Chakra. Thereupon Chakra bestowed half his throne upon the king. Meanwhile, the 500 meditators did not believe the king would ever succeed in conquering their dwelling place. When they saw him arriving with his army, one of the most powerful meditators took some water and sprinkled it around to prevent the army from passing beyond that point. Once the king found out that one of the meditators was impeding his army's advance, he asked the meditators to tell him their greatest desire. When they told him they wanted to have long hair, he made a wish for them all to become completely bald, and also for them to be driven away. As a result, all the meditators' hair began to fall out, and the people were able to chase them away. However, the king's wife remarked that it was not proper to treat them that way, since they were religious practitioners and should not cause trouble to others. So the king simply sent the meditators to another place. The king remained with Chakra and became extremely powerful. He reached the point where he thought he could fight and conquer the higher gods in addition to the lower gods and demigods. In fact, he began to think that he had become as powerful as Indra himself. This was an extremely wicked idea, and it produced a lot of negative karma. Eventually, all the merit he had accumulated in the past was used up. This caused him to fall from the heavenly realms back to the realms of the humans. After some time, he fell into a deplorable condition, and he reached the point of dying. People around him asked what they should tell the populace about how such a great king had died. He asked them to tell people that what had happened to him was a consequence of his not being satisfied, despite wielding such great power. That king was the present Buddha in one of his previous lives. Someone asked the Buddha once how he had come to gain that birth as a universal emperor, and the Buddha replied that it was due to karma performed in an earlier life. At one time, when another Buddha had passed by him, he had thrown 5 grains of pea seeds in that Buddha's direction. 4 of the 5 seeds had landed in the bowl, and 1 seed had landed on the rim where it remained. The 4 seeds which landed in the begging bowl resulted in his becoming the king of 4 continents, and the seed which landed on the edge resulted in his gaining half the power over heaven of the 33. So that's a story about contentment. So now the text goes into a discussion about generosity as a direct antidote to stinginess. His Holiness the 42nd Sakya Treason says that there are 3 kinds of generosity based on who is doing the practice. So the first group are the celibate bodhisattvas. That refers to monastics, but not only monastics. There are some other categories or groups who are celibate that are not monastics. So anybody who falls in that type of category is in the first group. The second group are householder bodhisattvas. And the third group are advanced or noble bodhisattvas. These are the bodhisattvas that obtain the levels of the bhumis, which we're going to go into quite a bit later. But very, very advanced spiritual practitioners are in a separate category. So that's one way of categorizing this. Another way is based on what is being given. There are 4 kinds of generosity in terms of what's given. The first one is giving fearlessness. Examples of that would be if an animal is about to be slaughtered and you buy it and bless it and release it and save it from the slaughter, that's taking away the fear of that animal being killed. And there's other examples too. The second category would be giving loving kindness. That's a category of generosity. The third category would be giving Buddha Dharma, teaching Dharma. And then the fourth category would be giving material wealth. Regarding the first category of celibate bodhisattvas, the Buddha said that they should explain the Dharma with a right motivation. And they're allowed to give very minor physical objects, for example, a pen or paper, something that's useful, but it's not, you know, extravagant. That's okay. But otherwise, they really shouldn't worry about accumulating material objects and giving them away. That's not the job of monastics. The Buddha said they would be better off focusing on the three trainings of morality, meditation, and wisdom. The giving of fearlessness could also include if somebody's in some kind of danger and you rescue them. You know, animals trapped in a fence or somebody's drowning or something like that. That's also included in that category. Then we come to the category of the lay practitioners. And there's two subsections here. One is how to perform the acts of generosity. And the second one is the method for training in those acts. Regarding how to perform the acts of generosity, Sakya Pandita says there's actually three stages to this. The first stage is you need to free yourself from the inability to give. At first, you train in just giving a little. For example, a cup of water. Or, they say in the text, a cup of cooked vegetables. And if a person has extreme stinginess and they really, really can't even do that, then the training involves putting 10 stones in one pocket, and then during the course of the day you give it to the other pocket. Which might sound kind of silly, but there are people who are really locked into this, you know, stinginess. So the point is you start small and work your way up. The second stage is to avoid impure generosity and train in pure acts of giving. We've already talked about impure generosity. The third one, to prevent even pure acts of generosity from failing to become causes of Buddhahood, train in turning them into causes of Buddhahood. We're going to talk about how to do that. His Holiness 42nd Sakyatrizin says, this is about impure generosity. For example, if we give something to a person in return for a gift we have received from them in the past, then our giving is impure. This is because at that time our giving is not based on compassion, nor an otherwise altruistic motive, but to repay that person. And if they also have no need for the gift we are giving them, then our generosity is also impure in relationship to the receiver. So if we give our material possessions to robbers out of fear, this too is impure giving due to the impure recipient. Impure objects include such things as weapons and alcohol. So no Christmas gifts of a bottle of wine, I guess. And then regarding impure intention, if we give things to others thinking that we will get something in return, our intention is not right. In short, impure generosity is giving based on impure recipients, objects, and intentions. Pure forms of generosity, on the other hand, can become the cause of attaining Buddhahood, although this does not apply to all forms of pure generosity. Some can be the cause of gaining higher rebirth, while others can be the cause of gaining the state of Shravaka Buddha or Pratyeka Buddha. To avoid these outcomes, we need to adopt great compassion, the method aspect of the path. And in this way, the method aspect of great compassion eliminates the extreme of nirvana, and the wisdom aspect overcomes the extreme of samsara. And with these two, method and wisdom, we can attain the state of non-situated nirvana, which is beyond both samsara and nirvana. This is why it's so important to practice generosity on the basis of great compassion and great wisdom. When our generosity is based on great compassion, it will not become the cause for gaining mere liberation or nirvana, and by practicing with wisdom, it will free us from samsara. Then, if we also have the power of diligence, we will practice with great joy, which will enable us to quickly accomplish the method and wisdom aspects needed in order to practice the perfection of generosity in a proper way. So now we go to the third stage of how to perform generosity. And regarding this, Sakya Pandita says, thus, having distinguished pure from impure acts of generosity, avoid the impure and train in the pure. Turn all pure acts of generosity into causes of awakening. Some acts of pure generosity do not become causes for attaining Buddhahood. For example, some roots of virtue result in a full measure of excellent attainments for gods or humans, the beings in the higher realms, while others become the cause for attaining the nirvana of the Shravaka or the Pratyeka Buddha. To prevent this, train in making all acts of giving, no matter how trifling, into causes for quickly attaining perfect Buddhahood. Do this by suppressing the extreme of nirvana through the skillful means, by suppressing the extreme of cyclic existence through discerning wisdom, and by quickly bringing to perfect completion both means and discerning wisdom through the power of energetic application. The Rinpoche says, the basis for giving is the mind. We will not be able to give properly unless we have developed the right attitude. If we do not create the wish to give, then when we see a beggar in the street, for example, the first thing we'll think is, oh, here comes somebody after my money. Instead of giving him something, we will want to chase him away. So in order to create the correct basis for the act of giving, we must develop the correct mental attitude, the wish to give joyfully, by reflecting in the following way. When we see a beggar coming toward us, we should remind ourselves that this is an opportunity for us to perform an act of generosity, enabling us to accumulate more merit and also to gain prosperity in future lifetimes. We should also see the beggar as an emanation of the Buddha or Bodhisattva, and reflect that by giving to him, we're pleasing all Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. In these ways, we should formulate ideas conducive to feeling joy and happiness in the act of giving. With regard to the recipients of generosity, there may be certain persons that we like giving to, and others we don't like giving to. For example, there are some who like to give to their teacher, but do not like to give to the Buddha, and some who like to give to the Buddha, but not to others. Some like to give to those who chant the sutras, but not the practitioners who study them. Some like to give to monks and nuns, but not to others. To redress this bias, we should increase our offerings to those we like giving to, and start giving small articles to others, thus training our minds to give happily to all. With regard to the time of giving, some of us prefer to make offerings only on special occasions like holy days, such as Buddha's Enlightenment Day, and don't wish to give on other days. To train ourselves in giving at all times, we should begin by increasing our offerings on days when we like to give, and think about giving on the days when we are not accustomed to making offerings. We can start to increase the length of our period of giving instead of giving just on a particular occasion. For example, we should increase it by promising to perform the practice of generosity for a few days, then for a month, for a year, for 10 years, and then for a lifetime. Also, with regard to the object, we should start giving small objects, such as a glass of water. After that, we can give the glass in addition to the water. We can increase the number of articles up to the point when we attain the first bhumi, at which time we will be able to give away our body. By the way, remember that only those who have gained this stage give away their body. His Holiness 42nd Saikatrizin says that there are two aspects of the generosity training. Now we're in another category now, the actual training. And he says there are two aspects of it, the mind aspect and the action aspect. And this connects with what we just read by Ape Rinpoche. His Holiness says that regarding the mind aspects, true bodhisattvas are happy just to hear the sound of someone asking for something, not to mention actually giving something to someone who's in need. All perfections are mainly mental practices. The mind wishing to give everything to all sentient beings is what he calls the mind practice of it. And he says that this also plants the seed to have inexhaustible wealth in the future. And that we should think that the people we give to are Buddhas, and we should not feel irritated if someone asks us for money or food. And he goes on to say that to attain Buddhahood, we need pure objects like the three jewels, but we also need impure objects like the sentient beings. For example, we go for refuge for the sake of all beings. Or developing our loving kindness and compassion towards living beings. We should see people in need as objects of our generosity. These examples are talking about giving material objects, but just a reminder, there are actually four categories: freedom from fear and teaching Dharma and so on. So what they're saying about objects also applies across the board. So that is in regard to the mental aspect of the training. Regarding the actual actions, His Holiness says that there are subdivisions in terms of recipient, time, and object given. We've already talked about this, but I'll say it again. So the recipient should not only be your guru and not only the Sangha, but it should be anybody in need. And that we shouldn't be so narrow-minded or selective in who we give to. And then again, we shouldn't just give on special occasions like Buddha's birthday and so on. We should practice generosity every day, including teaching. I think I mentioned you can teach Dharma to insects. When I lived in Italy, I lived right on the edge of town, and there were hills behind where I live, and I used to go up in the hills. It was full of insects. And I used to teach Dharma to the insects. And then, again, the object begins small, like with a cup of water or feeding animals. Train slowly. And always remember to dedicate your merit. The next topic in the text is entitled Correctly Accomplishing Generosity. And when I did the Complete Path training on this text, the teachers emphasized that this was really an important topic. This was a really important part of the text, and they went into quite a bit of detail with it. There are two sections here which are entitled Achieving the Four Excellent Qualities and Eliminating the Seven Attachments. So Ape Rinpoche says, but there are four positive qualities which must be associated with the practice of the perfection of generosity. Number one, all forms of its opposite, miserliness, must be discarded. Number two, it must be associated with the non-conceptual realization of the ultimate reality, the selflessness of persons and phenomena. Number three, by giving away whatever others want, in conformity with the doctrine, we must have the ability to fulfill the wishes of others. This goes back to what we mentioned last week, I think it was. Geshe Taishin Namgyo said that the essence of generosity is compassion. Seeing who's in front of you and what they need. You know? And then the fourth positive quality is, after sentient beings have been gathered through the practice of generosity, they must be ripened by being placed in one of the three paths according to their temporary race. That temporary race means, you know, where they are and what their propensity is. So the three yanas, there's different ways of classifying those, but generally it's Hinayana, Mahayana, Vajrayana, or Hinayana, Sutrayana, Vajrayana, or Pradyeka Buddha, Shravaka, Mahayana. There's different ways of categorizing them, but in any case, the point being, you see who's in front of you and what their propensity is, and then you help to ripen them in that direction. And we're going to go into that more in more detail later about this ripening of sentient beings process. But for now, these are the four positive qualities associated with the practice. Then there are seven attachments that must be abandoned while practicing each of the six perfections. With regard to the perfection of generosity, these are, number one, being attached to possessions. Number two, being attached to postponement, thinking that we do not have to give at this point, that we can give later. Yeah, I won't do it today, I'll do it tomorrow, I'll do it next week, get my paycheck, and then put it off, put it off, put it off. Number three, being attached to feeling satisfied with whatever we have given. Oh, I gave that guy a quarter, that's enough, come on. Number four, being attached to expecting returns in this lifetime. Instant karma is overrated. Number five, being attached to gaining a result in future lifetimes. Number six, being attached to miserliness itself, the opposite of generosity. And number seven, being attached to distractions. There are two kinds of distraction. The first is the distraction of speculation, which means taking pleasure in a lower vehicle. The second is the distraction of conceptual thought, which means conceptually grasping the three factors of the act of giving, the giver, the recipient, and the article. So again, to seal it with emptiness, we need to seal the receiver with emptiness. The receiver is not independently existent. The gift is not independently existent, and the giver is not independently existent. We need to really be free of that type of conceptual thinking, which here is, it's called a distraction. Interesting way to phrase it. So those are the four positive qualities and the seven attachments. I think at this point I'll ask if there's any questions about any of this. A lot of lists.
I kind of wonder about when giving to people on the street.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you want to protect them from harm. So if you give them money and then they go buy drugs with it, you're not really helping. So what's the answer to that? Like,
I had this discussion with Lama recently. Because he said, oh, I went downtown to Pandora Street and gave out a bunch of money. And I went, Lama, it's kind of dangerous down there. This is my opinion, and this is what I said to him. I said, my approach to that is to give to the people who distribute those funds appropriately in the right place to the right people at the right time. And so they don't go to the, you know, they don't end up being actually harming the person, you know. And I can't judge a person on the street. I don't know. It's not possible. It's not my job. So my solution is to give to the charities and let the charities distribute it. And you can argue about whether charities are good or bad or they're appropriate or not. But I think you have to have common sense about all of these things. Yep. So that's just my personal opinion about it. What do you think?
No, that makes sense to me, what you're saying. It's better to give to the charity that gives more to all, more people.
More, and also it's funneled in an appropriate way, which I could really never do personally. Right. Yeah.
And it also supports and encourages that kind of giving too.
Uh-huh.
It also seems like it's important to stay awake with whoever approaches you.
Mm-hmm.
And judge from your own experience momentarily as to whether it's appropriate or not. So it's a mix of how you've said it and including personal experiences with individuals.
And I should have added that because I believe that and I do that too. I don't do it too often, but I do, you know, suss out the situation and the person. And
yeah.
And in fact, I started carrying change in my pocket and now, deliberately, in case I run into somebody like that. But I've also had some very bad experiences, too, being threatened and stuff like that. That's why I think, you know, we have to have our eyes and ears open. And also, I'm not really a street person, so I don't really know how to make those judgments very well. But occasionally, it happens, and in those cases, I do give to individuals. So thank you for pointing that out. I should have mentioned that. Any other thoughts about that?
I usually give, I ask them what they need. So if they're, oh, I need food, then I sometimes actually used to carry food purposely to give to somebody, right? So I'd ask them, what is it that they need? Do you need food? You know, do you need clothing? What is it you need? If they, you know, a lot of times it's, oh, I need money to pay the rent. Well, I can't always help you with that. But I can give you food if you need food, right? So I kind of ask them that, I think, in my past. With people that say they need something. What is it you need?
Yeah. Something I've done in the past, and I'm not really doing it now for health reasons, but I used to notice that there were certain people on certain corners consistently.
Right.
And I used to go up and talk to them and get to know them and find out who they were and, you know, where the money was going to go. And there were cases where I felt comfortable giving to those individuals. I knew their names, I knew their story, I knew where they stayed. And they, just on the gut level, it felt okay, you know. But those were specific people that I got to know a little bit. I'm not doing that now because I don't go downtown anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like in Boda there are a lot of beggars, and some of them in really bad physical shape too. They really need help, and you know, your money can go pretty far that way. And I know a wonderful Amchi who does health camps up in the Solokumbu region, because that's where he's from, and he's a monk as well as a doctor. And just a, you know, sending him $100 a couple times a year means that he can do a whole health camp twice. You know.
Yeah.
He also pledges that when he gives massage to a Westerner, because the Tibetan people don't really believe in a lot of that stuff, that he uses that money exclusively for the health camps too. But yeah, it's wonderful, and he sends pictures of the people receiving.
Yeah. Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are plenty of worthy causes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Probably too many.
In the old days when there were bus tokens, I lived in Vancouver, in Gastown, before it became Gastown, when it was just cheap rent, you know.
Yeah.
I used to keep bus tokens in my pocket, and
oh, yeah.
On a cold night I would give out bus tokens because it can save somebody's life.
Yeah. Something I've done sometimes is you can go to a box store and you can buy like 20 or 30 pairs of socks in a bag really cheaply, and socks are always requested.
Yeah, it's true.
But I don't give them out individually. I take them down to the charity and have them give them. Actually, they have a free box or bin or something,
right.
And then the person that needs a pair of socks goes and gets it. And that way you know that your money isn't being used for something that's
right.
You know.
Yeah. I also give to the food bank.
Generosity is a big topic.
Yeah.
We haven't finished it. We'll continue it next time. But are there any other comments or questions before we do dedication?
I want to clarify, give away your body. What does that mean exactly?
This is very far away from our culture and time and place, but there are many stories about very highly advanced bodhisattvas who are met by spirit demons or somebody on the road who, for whatever reason, berates them and says, I'm not going to let you pass unless you give me your eye or something. And the bodhisattva just rip out their eye and give it to them, you know. Mm. Or cut off their leg or, you know, there's lots of stories about this. They're kind of odd from our time and point of view. But apparently these things happen, have happened, and do happen. But we, at our level, shouldn't do that. You need to be at this first bhumi, which is this incredibly high level where you can manifest 100 bodies instantaneously.
Mm-hmm.
For those beings, they have no attachment, and they also have no experience of suffering or pain or anything. So for them to cut off their hand or their eye or something, it's no big... I mean, it is a big deal, but it's not like it would be for us to do it. So we are told about it, but we're warned not yet, you know. But it's a long-term aspiration, maybe, you could say. That the point being, I think, for us is don't be so darn attached to your body, because look what we do. We spend a lot of money and time bathing it and clothing it and, you know, taking care of it. And that's one of our main attachments for most of us is our body. Even if you're not rich, you know, you can be attached to your body. You can buy $350 Nike outfit or something?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
It refers to these historical tales that are in these texts, but frankly, I skipped that part. Cause
I have a question for you. You're talking about this, not about the body. I don't know, would you say an example of that might be chud practice? Like, you know, and chud you... You can even do it mentally, where you're giving up your body and should.
Well, you do it mentally.
Well, you know, would you say that's an aspect of that maybe as well?
Well, that's a practice which is mental but not physical.
Yeah.
Which is what a perfection is. These stories are actual physical.
You're talking about actual physical, not mental
practice. That's the way I read it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, what good is an eye or a hand to someone when it, you know, what are they going to do? Where are they going to attach it? And is it going to work? I don't think so.
You have to ask the demons, you know. But there is this idea of karmic debt.
Oh, yeah.
We make offerings, for example, to the spirit landlords, the environmental spirits, to pay back any debt that we might have to them. A lama does it every morning out here.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, I'm guessing that these spirits, perhaps there was some debt that they felt that needed to be repaid.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, I don't know. It's very kind of, like I said, it's kind of far away from our culture. Mm-hmm. Although people give away their kidneys for transplants and things like that, so maybe it's not so far away under certain circumstances. It's all contextual, you know. It's all according to the context and your motivation, of course.
What about somebody that maybe does good deeds for people that maybe are demonic? You know what I mean? Like, say you're out there laboring for people, giving your body to help, and you have... these people are demonically possessed. You know what I mean? Like,
not exactly.
An example would be, I know a story of a woman that saved other women from being raped, that she was giving her body in place.
Oh.
Do you see what I'm saying? It's a horrible scenario, but in a way that is giving up your body to save other beings. I mean, I would look at that as a bodhisattva that's giving herself up for others.
I'm not sure I want to touch that topic. Everything always depends on your motivation. Mm-hmm. So that needs to be there for sure.
Exactly.
I don't know. I don't think I want to go there.
Yeah, no, I understand.
I remember Geshe-la one time saying that if you can give, you have to. And if you can't, it's good enough to wish you could. It's good enough to wish you could. And holding those kinds of wishes eventually leads to a position where you can.
Yeah.
So that wish is in effect an accomplishment in itself.
Yeah. Thank you, Geshe-la.
Yeah, it's the great thing about aspirations.
Yeah. There's no shortage of opportunity for generosity, that's for darn sure. Even if aspiring.
Oh, yeah.
Even if you don't actually give every day, you can aspire every day.
Yeah.
Next week, we're going to go into the benefits of generosity. So stay tuned for that. Let's say the dedication prayer now, I think. So nam dei tam jesi pani tob na ne pedanam bam jete te gana chi palum trupe sit pe sole do adu parsho jang jub sem chogrin poche Ma ke manon ge gyurje ge manyam parme paryam gong ne gong tu pel parsho jam pa pa o ji dar ken pa dang gun tu sang po de yang de jin de de da gun By this merit, may all attain omniscience, may attain the inner from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death,
from the ocean of samsara,
may all beings be free. Bodhicitta is precious, may it arise in all beings in whom it has not arisen, May it never decline where it has arisen, but may it ever grow and flourish. In whatever way Manjushri and Samantabhadra know how to transfer merit, so do I dedicate all of my own virtues, that I may train to be like them. Through this dedication, praised as supreme by the victorious Buddhas of the past, present, and future, I, together with all sentient beings, dedicate these roots of virtue to attaining Buddhahood. May whatever virtue I may have gained from prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, requesting, and beseeching be dedicated to attaining perfect enlightenment.
Thank you,
Mark. Thank you.